This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, say a police officer one day stops you, asks for ID, and then runs a routine check on you. He finds an outstanding small traffic warrant. Then you get arrested based on that warrant, not for anything you were doing when the officer stops you. And of course, after that, you get searched. The officer finds drugs in your pocket, and you get charged with a serious drug crime. Seems pretty straightforward, except for one key wrinkle, that initial stop. What if a state court ruled that the first stop the cop made was illegal because there was no reasonable individual suspicion that you were doing anything wrong? So here's the question. Were your Fourth Amendment rights violated? Well, according to the United States Supreme Court this week, the answer is no. The actual case is Utah versus Strife. A Salt Lake City police officer did actually make such an illegal stop, but the high court ruled on Monday 5-3 that there was no flagrant police misconduct. Writing for the majority, Justice Clarence Thomas asserts that, quote, Evidence is admissible when the connection between unconstitutional police conduct and the evidence is remote. However, Justice Sonia Sotomayor fired back with a blistering dissent. Do not be soothed by the opinion's technical language, she wrote. It says that your body is subject to invasion while courts excuse the violation of your rights. It implies that you are not a citizen of a democracy, but the subject of a carceral state just waiting to be cataloged. So there's a lot to take in. Nancy Gertner is here to help us understand it. She is a retired federal judge and current Harvard Law School professor and WBUR's legal analyst. Welcome back to the show, Nancy.
Great to be here.
Okay, so this case, Utah versus Strife. I'm going to guess that perhaps you are more in agreement with Justice Sotomayor's analysis than you are with Justice Thomas's.
Yes. When you think about the case, think about what it enables. So the exclusionary rule is the way that we enforce appropriate legal norms.
It's okay, way, so stop right there.
Yeah, right.
The exclusionary rule,
right,
which
okay.
is central to this case.
Right.
What does that mean?
This is a rule that has been around for decades. It is that what you do is you exclude evidence that was obtained as a result of an illegal search.
Okay.
And you exclude it from any subsequent criminal prosecution. And we do this, even though it seems strange to some, as a way of enforcing legal norms. You tell the police you can't make use of the fruits of an illegal search, and in the hopes that they therefore will not illegally search. And the other argument is that once you know that something has been introduced as from an illegal search, that you don't want the court to be part of allowing it in and therefore be sort of part of that illegality.
Okay, so, and this is a court-developed standard that's been around for a long time
in the United States.
But on the other hand, but Justice Thomas, writing for the majority, said that the court's precedent do not call for excluding evidence, quote, when the costs of exclusion outweigh its deterrent benefits.
Right, so the case is significant on a number of fronts. One is the extent to which it legitimizes a search to find out identification and find out if there's an arrest warrant. Because the notion here is that this is an illegal stop. When the officer asked for his identification, this would have been an illegal part of an illegal stop.
Which the state of Utah didn't even challenge.
But because they came up with a valid warrant that legitimized, enabled the officer to search. So what it does is, when you don't exclude this, you now enable police officers to say, even those with the best of intentions, well, hell, I'll stop this person. Maybe I'll find something. That is precisely the analysis that the Constitution doesn't allow or shouldn't allow. I'm going to stop you, Meghna, just in case there's somewhere I can find, by the way, an arrest warrant for either a misdemeanor or a felony or a traffic stop. And who among us has not forgotten, you know, to pay a fine?
Well, so the court, the majority, it was a 5-3 ruling. And by the way, a ruling that was done, of course, with Justice Antonin Scalia not on the bench, which is, we can talk about that in a moment. But it seems to revolve around a couple issues. One, the exclusionary rule, as we talked about.
Right.
The other is this idea that the initial stop, in the eyes of the majority, was not a, quote, flagrant violation?
It was two things. So they recognized that it was illegal. Everyone concedes that it was an illegal
but
stop.
But not flagrant.
Well, but the notion was it was an illegal stop, getting the ID, finding out about the traffic warrant, and then searching. And what the court was trying to say is the search then a product of the illegal stop, or was it somehow attenuated? Was it somehow distant from the original stop because we found out something that was independently valid? And so that was part of the analysis. And then the second part of the analysis is, even if it was independently valid, if it were flagrant in some way, we would then consider suppressing it. The flagrant test narrows the exclusion so much, because what the Fourth Amendment law was trying to get at was not officers who were intentionally trying to undermine your rights. The exclusionary rule was trying to get at people who may have, in good faith, wrongly applied constitutional standards and stopped you when they shouldn't, stopped you for the most legitimate of reasons, which is, well, maybe you're committing a crime, but we don't allow stops to be done on that kind of insubstantial ground.
Oh, interesting, because it seems as if Justice Thomas, disagrees with that analysis. I mean, he wrote that it was a result of, quote, good faith mistakes, and that the illegal stop was at worst an isolated instance of negligence.
Right. Well, that had never been the standard before. So, I mean, if an officer really, 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 really believes you've done something wrong, really believes it, but in fact has no concrete basis to believe it at all, and he gives this the old college try, I'll just stop you and then I'll wind up searching you and coming up with something. This legitimizes that and says that the only way we will exclude it is if you intended to do something wrong. That substantially dilutes the protection. Ordinary investigation, the old college try, let me see if I can shake down this person. It legitimizes all of that kind of behavior.
So what are the potential consequences of this ruling? Because, I mean, Justice Sonia Sotomayor issued this blistering 12-page dissent in which she says very straightforwardly she's concerned that, quote, this case tells everyone, white and black, guilty and innocent, that an officer can verify your legal status at any time. And basically, as I read earlier, another excerpt from her dissent, she believes that we're living in a carceral state now.
Well, what it really does legitimize officers stopping people to check their identification without basis in the hopes that you'll come up with a warrant somewhere that will then, after the fact, legitimize what you did. Now, when you think about the numbers of warrants I think it was in Sotomayor's dissent, she talked about 180,000 misdemeanor warrants that were outstanding. I think she was talking about Utah, but I'm not sure. You talk about the numbers of outstanding warrants. You talk about mistakes in the system, that there might be a warrant that is outstanding. And then when you talk about the impact of warrants, including traffic warrants, on people of color, this is an extraordinary decision.
Well, Justice Sotomayor referenced Ferguson specifically as well in the report, and there are communities that have much, much higher per capita rates of these warrants, as you said, and they do fall disproportionately on communities of color. But on the other hand, I mean, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Alito said at one point in time during the discussion of this case that most states and municipalities do not have those huge numbers of outstanding arrest warrants, thereby eliminating any incentive that law enforcement, that police officers or police groups would have to do these stops, as you're referring to.
But think of it this way. So if I arrest you and I find no warrant, no foul, right? I can't then do anything further. I can't search you because there is no warrant. You have simply been stopped illegally, undignified. Your rights have been undermined. If I find a warrant, however, I can then search you, and the fruits of the search then can be admitted. So essentially, it certainly gives a police officer the incentive to, give it his best shot. Hmm. What's to prevent that? If he finds something, a warrant, then he can go forward and the fruits can be admitted. If he finds nothing, no foul.
It sounds like you are concerned that this could be a precedent-setting case that changes policing.
Well, that's right. I mean, the exclusionary rule was a controversial rule even when the court fashioned it. And there's no question that the court has narrowed it over the years, and particularly this court has narrowed it. But this is a narrowing that invites really, think about it. This invites identification questions, stopping people on the street to get their IDs. What does that sound like to you? I mean, to me, it really resonates with, to use Sotomayor's words, a carceral state. It really resonates with a totalitarian state. We certainly hope police will not regularly do this. But if we have now justified sort of good faith investigation, even if illegal, good faith investigative techniques, even if illegal, what's to prevent an officer from doing that as to those he suspects of crime, which could be any of us?
Nancy Gertner is a retired federal judge. She's a Harvard Law School professor now and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now briefly from the SCOTUS case on the Fourth Amendment to efforts to educate students about their Fifth Amendment rights. That's, of course, the right not to make any self-incriminating statements. A group of Boston attorneys has started teaching Boston public school students about their rights, in particular, the Miranda warning. You know, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law, etc. The lawyers say they want to empower students while also dispelling some myths about the legal system. WBUR's Zeninjor Enwemeka has this report.
All right, guys, take a seat where you'll be successful, all right?
Students file into Tommy Simmons' 8th grade humanities class at Lila G. Frederick Middle School in Dorchester. This year, they're reading about the civil rights era. But today, they're getting a different lesson, how to assert their civil rights. Their instructors are attorneys Nate Kozloff and Clark Freeman.
So today we're here, as you know, to talk about Miranda rights. So what is it that happens when a person is arrested, say, like...
What might the police officers say?
Oh, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say or do can and will be used against you in the court of law.
14-year-old Jermida Horton can recite the words. Now she's learning what they mean.
And I've, like, seen cop shows before, and I never knew it was, like, a Miranda right. I just thought it was something that they had to say.
Like Horton, many of the students' ideas about law come from TV. The lawyers are teaching them how to exercise their rights in the real world. 14-year-old Rashaw Stone explains to attorney Clark Freeman what he understands the rights to mean.
If you stay silent, it'll be better off because if you say anything... like, it'll be used against you, so...
That's true. It is often wise to stay silent. So what this means is that when the police come and talk to you...
You don't have to answer.
You don't have to answer when you're under arrest.
Wait.
Yeah.
So what if we pull you over? Do you have to answer the question?
Nate Kozloff chimes in.
You have to answer certain identifying questions. So if they ask you your name, and if they ask you to show an ID, then you have to comply with those requests. But more substantive questions... Were you here? Do you know this person? Those more detailed questions, you can assert your right to remain silent at that point.
Many of the students lean forward. Some are skeptical. Do you really not have to answer police? The key question here, the students learn, is are you in the custody of police? Tommy Simmons puts that question to his class. And once again, Jermida Horton speaks up.
We learned there are two questions you can ask to determine whether or not you are in custody.
You actually are under arrest.
And even if you're not under arrest, you might still be in custody, but what question would you ask? Is the door locked, right? What is the question?
Oh, may I leave?
Am I free to go?
Am I free to go?
And if the answer is no, then you're in custody. If the answer is yes, then you're not.
Well, it was very interesting because most of the things that they were talking about, I didn't even know.
14-year-old Brianna Pusey was one of the students who found the class not just informative, but useful.
So if, like, we're in that situation where we get stopped by a cop, we know what to do. We know the rights that we have.
Interactions between police and youth have received a lot of attention over the last couple years, following a string of deadly police shootings and violent interactions between unarmed black youth and law enforcement. Those are high-profile incidents, but there are also everyday encounters with police. Teacher Tommy Simmons says more than ever, it's important for students to understand the legal system and what their rights are.
Their perception of the police and law enforcement is very negative, and I think as a country it's pretty negative right now. And these attorneys came in and showed the kids that they can, when dealing with law enforcement, it doesn't have to be combative, but it does have to be fair and just. And now they know what fair and just is supposed to look like.
In fact, the attorneys told the students there are times they should talk openly with the police. and it might even be in their best interest to do so. But Nate Kozlov says the students should always be aware that they have a choice.
This isn't just advice for guilty people. It's advice for innocent, guilty, know your rights so you know how to navigate the system appropriately.
Today's class was part of a program run by the Boston Bar Association. Carol Starkey is the incoming president.
There couldn't be any more significant principles than those of saying you don't have to be forced to give evidence against yourself when you're being accused of something.
Those principles were established 50 years ago this month by the Supreme Court in the landmark case Miranda v. Arizona. Starkey says half a century later, it's crucial to learn about those rights early.
And that's important for all citizens to understand, and especially young adults, you know, and young kids, as they're coming into their adulthood and they're starting to participate in society in many different ways. And, you know, we all know that they're going to have experiences that are both fair and unfair.
The Miranda classes were held in schools across Boston, from high school to as young as second grade. Starkey led one of the elementary school sessions.
And I was a little concerned. You know, this is kind of a heady concept, going in and teaching kids that age. But I will tell you, these children understand what it means not to be treated fairly. They understood what it meant to be accused of something they didn't do.
It's important to note, too, that Massachusetts has additional protections for juveniles when it comes to Miranda rights. Those under 14 must have an adult with them when they're questioned. And the law encourages those over 14 be given an opportunity to consult an adult before they're considered to have waived their Miranda rights. Back at Lila Frederick Middle School, the class gave Jermida Horton a spark of civic engagement. At 14, she's already considering becoming a lawyer. Today's lesson made it clear to her how important it is to know the law.
I think it's helpful because some kids our age are in trouble with the system, so maybe it could help them depending on their situation.
And that goes beyond her friends and classmates.
And it's just something good to know, like it's nothing negative. You could help your parent or whoever if they ever got pulled over. And if you know something, you could speak up because you know the rights.
Not just words the police say, but rights these students now know they have.
That report from WBUR's Zeninjor and Wemeka. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.